Okay, how many of you remember Dallas? Okay, and in the connecting question, did you answer that that was your favorite? Really? Well, remember, for those, I told you this was generational. Of course, it's now come back. But anyway, it was a story, right, about the antics, the squabbling of this wealthy but highly dysfunctional Texas family that were constantly trying to figure out who was in control of their oil business. And at the heart of the show, of course, was JR, right? Yeah, man, I'll tell you. Wasn't he a piece of work? I'll tell you, right? Every week, we would tune in to see his despicable, conniving, and dirty, rotten scoundrel ways as he tried to control his business. And his motto, I think, was, there's really nothing dirty if you win the game. Well, for me, Dallas was more of a great way to learn what family dysfunction is all about, you know? It kind of defined it for me, because we'd see these family members scheming and backstabbing and manipulating them each other, and somehow it didn't make us feel so bad about our own families, right? Dysfunctional families like the Ewings have been around for a very long time. And today we're going to look at, I think, what has to be one of the most manipulative, dysfunctional families in the whole Bible. And it's the story of the family of Isaac and Rebecca. And maybe we ought to rename today's theme from Jacob's Ladder to Dallas, the story of the Old Testament, Esau and Jacob's saga. So, we're going to kind of pretend we're going to put this TV show together, okay? And so, we've got to build the first scene. So, I need you to open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 25, because we're going to actually go way before the readings that we had today to kind of get an idea of just how this family operated and how it all began. So it's on page 21 of our church Bibles. And as you find this, I'm going to ask you a question. The question is this: where does family dysfunction begin? Okay? Well, in this case, it began in the womb. That's right. It began in the midst of a struggle, a difficult pregnancy. Listen to how the Bible describes Rebecca's pregnancy. Verse 22. The children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is to be this way, why do I live? Okay? Does that describe anybody's pregnancy? Okay? I remember how uncomfortable Jeannie was the weeks leading up to the birth of our twins. And every once in a while she'd get, I think they're doing somersaults right now. I wish they'd stop. So we get why Rebecca complains. Unfortunately, as she complains to God, he turns it around and gives her, well, not for good news. Look in verse 23. He says, two nations are in your womb. What? Two people are born. They're going to be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. And you have to underscore what is going to be this lifelong struggle, this competitive between twins. Their birth becomes a race as to who's going to be born first, with their both being delivered at the same time. I mean, our twins were 17 minutes apart. Here is one, bam, bam, and he's holding on onto the heel of the other. And all we can say is, that poor woman, oh my goodness, what she had to go through. Wow. Now, do you know what one of the most important, one of the things that parents of twins worry about the most is whether one is favored over the other. I mean, that's the whole key to raising twins. You got to treat them the same. Look what happens here. How tragic their lives begin. Verse 27. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was exactly opposite, a quiet man, living in tents. He was a shepherd. Now listen to this. Father Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game. But mother Rebekah loved Jacob. How terrible. How awful for these two young boys. They become pawns in a war. Competition in the womb. Competition at birth. Competition because of their personality differences. Competition because of their professions. All aggravated and inflamed by terrible, terrible parenting. We shift to scene two, birthright stew. Can we say Jacob, let's call him JR, Jacob, okay? He lived up to his name here. Jacob means by the heel, but it also means supplanter or displacer. That's exactly what he does to Esau. He swindles him out of his inheritance, his birthright. He displaces him. Here's how it's explained in verse 29. Once, when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me have some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I'm about to die, so what use of a birthright is it to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright. Both boys don't shine too brightly here. There's Esau, short-sighted, impulsive, willing to give away his inheritance. Is he out of his mind? Land? Animals? Money? All because he can't wait to cook what he's hunted? Come on. And then there's conniving little creepy J.R. Jacob, who won't share food with his own flesh and blood. I mean, come on. You gotta wonder how long's he been planning this one, cooking up this stew. Just waiting. He knew his brother. Scene three, messing with the blessing, okay? It seems like Isaac and Rebecca's parenting skills, well, they don't get any better, okay? They're not improving with experience here. Frustrated that Esau marries outside the clan, outside the faith, he marries two hated Canaanite women. And that really makes Rebecca angry. So she starts to manipulate things again. She overhears that Isaac is about to give the final last will and testament kind of thing to the oldest son. So she and Jacob plot together, disguising Jacob with fake fur so that the blind and enfeebled Isaac would mistakenly bless him instead of the one who deserved it, Esau. You see, back then, this last final blessing was incredibly important. It was a big deal because it was sort of like a father passing on a prophetic blessing. Once he would say something, they believed that it would actually come to pass. And once you said it, the words were alive, and you couldn't take them back. So with animal furs on his neck and his arms, savory food in hand, let's just call him this devious, Jacob crawls into his father, his poor, blind, old father, and he says, "My father, I'm Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game so that you may bless me, and I get it all." Surprised at how quick Esau has gone out. This pretend Esau goes out. Hans comes back, dresses the game, cooks it up. He gets a little suspicious. Isaac questions him, and his questions are met with more lies. And listen to what his lies reveal about his faith. When Isaac says, "How did you do it so quickly?" Jacob says, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Do you get what's going on there? Jacob doesn't believe in God. He could care less about God. He says, "Your God, it's not mine." That reveals just a despicable person who considered himself far outside God. So he lets Isaac feel his fur-covered arms, smell his outdoorsy clothes, eats his food, and devour his lies. And the deception is complete. Jacob, J.R., steals Esau's blessing. It's not hard for us to imagine the next scene, the fugitive years, right? The family dysfunction has now blossomed into hate, into anger, and threat of violence. Rebecca overhears some of the gossip from the slaves, and she warns Jacob, "Your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey me. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him a while your brother's fury turns away and he forgets what you've done to him." Fat chance that's going to ever happen. And here we find Jacob fleeing for his life, alone, anxious. And he's lost absolutely everything. And somewhere on his journey, we suddenly come to another scene. He stops. He has nothing. He doesn't have a pillow. So he grabs a stone to lay us down on. And he falls asleep, and he has this strange dream. Next slide. The angels are coming up and down this staircase. And suddenly God appears to teach up this messed up fugitive. He can't run away from God. God will always find him no matter what, no matter how badly he's screwed up at home. So God says to him, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. You may have run away from me, but I found you. The land on which you are lying on, I will give you and to your offspring, and your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth." And of course, we should be saying, this sounds vaguely familiar. "And all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and in your offspring." That also sounds familiar. "Know that I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I am done with what I have promised you." And in this weird dream, Jacob finally wakes up. God is healing this broken and terribly flawed man. And he wakes up in more ways than one. He's changed. He's transformed. That's what God's love and forgiveness can do in a person's life. No matter how far Jacob has run, God has found him. And what's more, these promises he scoffed at, these promises he ignored, promises to his grandfather and to his father, Isaac, promises he could scarcely believe in because of all his scheming and manipulative ways, all of a sudden become real for the first time in his life. And he exclaims, "Surely the Lord is in this place." It's like God is standing right there. And he says, "I didn't even realize this." Overcome with God's presence and love, he says, "How awesome is this place. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Now, we could wish that Jacob is completely healed of all his manipulative and dysfunction in his life. But he isn't. I just think there are too many shattered lives scattered all around him. But he's on the journey. He's beginning. And that journey of healing that begins at that place leads to reconciliation with his brother Esau. And his gradual understanding of God's promise to him, "I will bless you so that you will be a blessing to others." So the TV show is ended. It's complete, at least for this week's installment. So what are we going to go home with today? What part does this story play in the larger story of God? I'd like to suggest two. One is this: we can't run away far enough that God can't find us. Good news. That's really good news. Jacob really tried to run as far as he could. He went out in the middle of nowhere. But you see, when every place in this world is a potential house of God, a place of God where he can be, where it connects to heaven, there's no place to go. There's absolutely none. He's everywhere. And isn't it good to know that his promise to Jacob is the same to us? This promise you can take to work tomorrow. This promise you can take back to your family. This promise you can tell your kids over and over again. Know that I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. Isn't that a great promise? In that difficult situation you face this week, you're not alone. There's someone right there along your side. But more importantly, I think it's a deeper thing to take home. And this is, God can use dysfunctional, flawed people like Jacob, like you, like me. That's the amazing thing about this story and the rest of the story. God is constantly doing miracles, taking a manipulative, dirty, rotten scoundrel, and he doesn't give up on him. He heals him. He forgives him. And he chooses him to continue to bless others. And if he can do that with Jacob, can he do it with you? Can he do it with me? Well, let's find out. Amen.